in business administration from Webster University, completed in 1982. Bruce and Gail have been lay leaders at MLUUC for several years. They have two grown sons, Jacob, who lives in New York City, and Jordan, who lives in Dallas, Georgia. Bruce's favorite hobby is volunteering as a trip leader and whiteboarder raft guide and trainer for the Touch the Earth Outdoor Recreation Program at Georgia State University. Bruce also volunteers as a veteran mentor with the Veterans Treatment Court for the Appalachian Judicial Circuit. That's a mouthful. Which serves Pickens, Gilmer, and Fannin counties. And the title of Bruce's talk today is Legitimate Target.
Thanks, Carl. You will not like some of the ideas that I express here this morning. Some of them include a challenge. And that's appropriate for UUs, more so than for most others. We thrive on challenges to our presumptions, and we use those challenges as stepping stones forward in our search for the holy. War is not simple. UUs don't like simple. So these challenges just may be welcome. We'll talk about four main ideas connected conceptually and exemplified by our veterans. Each contains a call or a challenge. Those main ideas are legitimate target, unconditional acceptance, forgiveness, and the rule of law. Every veteran of every service here throughout American history has volunteered to be a legitimate target for other soldiers to kill. Legitimate, literally, by law, a target for other soldiers to kill. Our laws support that enemy soldier in killing me. When we capture an enemy soldier, our laws require us to protect that enemy and to care for him until the war stops, and then return him home in one piece. All veterans volunteered to place themselves in that position. That position is unique among other heroic, often validly romanticized professions, such as law enforcement, firefighters, first responders and rescuers, doctors and nurses. It is not legitimate for an arsonist to kill a firefighter. It is not legitimate for a criminal to kill a police officer, but it is morally and legally acceptable for soldiers to kill each other. This situation requires us, challenges us, calls us to see combat from the point of view of another who is trying to kill you. As soon as I say it is okay, legitimate, for me to kill him, I admit that it's okay, legitimate, for him to kill me. That is a call to implement the moral principle of reciprocity in life and death terms. For life and death stakes. Civilians, in contrast, are not legitimate targets. No law supports our killing them. No country has ever tried harder or risked its own soldiers' lives more to avoid civilian casualties. This is a hard and challenging question. How can a veteran fight in a war, the strategic objectives of which he does not agree with, or about which he knows his nation's leaders are deceiving the public in order to justify that war and pursue hidden motives, or when those motives are just dumb. How do you do that? How do you pick up that rifle and go to war under those circumstances? The answer is embedded in basic training and throughout our history and in our practice. It's about the soldier next to you. That band of brothers and sisters is real. It's not a myth. Even if you don't like that other person, it doesn't matter. You share the foxhole. That camaraderie is based on shared values and commitments, not tribe. And the camaraderie is often stronger among people who are not of that same ethnic heritage or race or religion when they serve together in combat. Two wars that recently in which I faced that very question, Afghanistan versus Iraq. I volunteered for both. I believed in the mission in Afghanistan. I thought that was worth doing. We needed to do that. I did not agree with that invasion of Iraq, but I volunteered to go. I didn't get that position. I volunteered as an individual, had to work through bureaucracy to get to go. I was never part of an organization that was mobilized and deployed as a unit. I was volunteered as an individual. But I volunteered to go to Iraq and got other missions instead, because that's where my army was committed. So that's when I go. Because I raised my hand and swore to do that. So I'll do it. In Vietnam, I disagreed with that. I just didn't get drafted, luckily. But had I been drafted, I would have gone. And I had that moral, age 19, I had that morally resolved that I would go so that somebody else wouldn't have to. I'm a white male. Middle class, privileged. I'm the one on the receiving end of most of the benefits of this nation. An inordinate burden for fighting in Vietnam was placed on people who did not enjoy my position of privilege. The poor, the less educated, black folks, Latinos, Native Americans. Far disproportionate representation in frontline combat troops than for white guys like me. So if I had been drafted, I would have gone. Not a big deal, but that's one slot that black kid or that poor kid wouldn't have to fill because I was there. Citizens of a democracy are responsible for everything their government does or fails to do, even when those government actions are dumb or immoral. And soldiers bear that burden. Throughout history, warriors have shown a counterintuitive empathy for each other, even among former enemies. That empathy and mutual respect often transcends the desire for vengeance. Rising above vengeance provides an example of a kernel of forgiveness. Anytime we're called to forgive, we are also called to rise above vengeance. Soldiers have done this throughout history. We are called to ask, how do I see myself from the point of view of, in my case, the Taliban? Liberian bandits, bloodiest murderers on earth, people forced children to murder their own parents. How do I see my position from their point of view? local crooks and corrupt officials and Russian infiltrators in the country of Georgia from one end of their government to the other. How do they see me as a threat? Who am I from their point of view as I stand on their land as an invader? Even at the point of remembering our warriors, especially our fallen, we can join with former or even current enemies in paying respect to their soldiers, especially their fallen. According to our laws, it is illegal for our soldiers to do anything other than that. Our soldiers are in legal jeopardy if they desecrate the bodies of a fallen enemy. Like torture, we consider that behavior uncivilized and immoral for us to do that, even if the enemy does it to our soldiers. Animosity to the point of flaming hatred among enemy soldiers is natural, reasonable, understandable, expected. We train soldiers to harness the energy of that rage in order to accomplish that military mission. You expect the rage, you expect the hatred, and it's a powerful weapon. Empathy among enemies is not natural. It is not reasonable or understandable or expected. This is a difficult call to answer. It is a moral challenge, and it provides an insight into the price of forgiveness. Forgiveness is odd. It is not reasonable. It is not normal. Vengeance is normal, not forgiveness. To show empathy to a former enemy without words contains two thoughts. One thought is, I forgive you. The other thought is, will you forgive me for trying to kill you? History provides many examples. One of the most profound of which in American history is in memory of Pickett's charge during the Civil War. Several decades after that fight at Gettysburg, veterans, actual veterans, not reenactors, but old guys who were there, put on almost like a parade, but good Lord, can you imagine the emotion invested in this activity where the Southern survivors lined up, those that were left, the Union survivors lined up in the defensive positions that were left, and the Confederate veterans advanced up the hill toward the Union soldiers. They didn't get halfway there before the Union soldiers came out of their defensive positions and embraced their enemies. In Afghanistan, I served with the senior staff of the Afghan National Army, helped build that Afghan National Army. The Minister of Defense was a former Mujahideen. Other members on his staff, others were former Mujahideen as well, but other members of the staff were former Afghan Army soldiers when an Afghan army was run by the Soviets. They were enemies. And these guys would stand around and laugh and joke and slap each other on the back. They knew each other. They knew each other's families. They talked about how when the United States entered anti-aircraft missiles, rockets into the Mujahideen, they could literally stand on the mountaintops and shoot down at Soviet helicopters. And these guys were former Soviet helicopter pilots. They were the ones who were training the Afghan National Army president. Those guys forgave each other, and they were working together on a common mission to build the Afghan National Army. In Liberia, I worked very closely with a civilian, but it was a civil war, so sort of everybody was civilian involved in the destruction of Liberia. Muhammad Kamara was his name, good friend, traveled with him all over the country, and we were trying to get former fighters into the process of reconciliation and disarmament and so forth. And he had been chased by the Liberian army that was under Charles Taylor out of the country. His family threatened, and for years, he was running around the world there in that part of Africa with these guys on his heels trying to kill him. And now we're sitting here in meetings working together, and I could have it in private. I said, Kamara, how do you do that? You guys were trying to kill you. I wanted to shoot them. How is it that you can rise above that? He said, the shooting. We tried that. Didn't work. It's that simple. We tried all that shooting. Didn't work. There was a Russian colonel on the staff of the United Nations mission in Liberia who had been to Afghanistan. And when I served in Liberia, I had also been to Afghanistan. This guy was, I mean, he was the epitome of the Russian colonel. No neck, beef. He looked like he could bench press a Buick, blonde hair, blue eyes, square face, Slavic warrior. Good dude. Good guy. I worked with him more easily, or at least as easily, as anybody else that I worked with in the country. He was there as a civilian. He did civil operations. I did civil military operations, so we worked together a lot. And we talked about Afghanistan. And I said, you know, this was back in 2004. After the first tour in Afghanistan in 2002, 2003. I said, well, it's going well so far. He said, that's what we thought. Just wait. He was right. The Vietnamese, North and South, on the death of John McCain, said that McCain helped heal the wounds of war. When I went to China, not military, this was civilian, running a collaborative planning and problem solving conference. There were representatives from many different countries in this particular conference. One of those countries was Vietnam. So here are these representatives in this conference from Vietnam, and they knew I was a retired Army colonel. There was no question about that. It was advertised. I was moved by their willingness to forgive me. Remember that question. Will you forgive me for trying to kill you? Their answer was, yes. Now let's get to work. In the country of Georgia, I worked very well with the Georgian military. I was there as a liaison with the Georgian military. We worked very well together. But remember, Georgia is a former Soviet republic. All the senior officers that I worked with in the Georgian army had been in the Soviet army. Nevertheless, we worked together. We spent our careers from the 70s all the way through the scenario we were trained to implement was to kill each other. And here we are working together to help build the nation. Georgia, build a secure Georgia. One specific example, an American Special Forces colonel that I worked with, and he was a very dear friend. Earlier in his career, his mission, his training for his Special Forces unit was to go to a particular part of the former Soviet Union in that area. I don't know that it was on the ground in Georgia, but it was very close to that. And a Georgian, former Soviet, colonel that we worked with very closely had as his specific individual mission catching and ambushing American Special Forces soldiers who were coming into that area to try to instill the conflict as a special operations mission. Literally, those two men spent significant parts of their own personal careers training to kill each other. And they became fast friends. That specific mission to kill each other evolved into a trusted friendship and co-worker relationship. Each was confident in the other's competence and courage as an example of forgiveness among warriors. How do we learn from the veteran's example? What does it mean for any U.S. citizen to volunteer, to step up, to declare himself or herself a legitimate target? What does respect for the adversary look like? Knowing that the enemy also accepted the mantle of legitimate target in defense of his or her values from their perspective. What if we and they share at least some values? Of course, we don't share them all, but what if we share at least some values? On that values foundation, shared values foundation, we can build forgiveness and we can build peace. The rule of law serves as a self-imposed governor for our behavior. We codify that governor in the rule of law and for combatants in the laws of war. That's almost a contradiction in term. Laws of war. How can that be? How can war be legal? Well, for most of history, it's not. But we impose that legal structure. That's a moral demand that we place upon ourselves to actually have laws of war. We impose the structure of civilization onto war, which is the least civilized of human behavior. That's a choice we make. It's an exercise of free will. It's a challenge we meet. It's a call we answer. For an example, one that doesn't have anything to do with war, but a similar example, an analogy, much easier for us to accept than within the context of war. The purpose of the First Amendment is not to guarantee free speech for myself as a white male, 6 feet tall, with a middle-class Protestant political moderate background. I don't need that guarantee very much. All I have to do is ally myself with and identify myself publicly with the majority tribe. I pretty much say what I want. The challenge is the First Amendment is to morally and legally obligate myself to defend the freedom of expression for someone very different from me or whose expressions I despise. Only a determined act of free will can lead us to impose such a moral imperative on ourselves. I remember the day that I started contributing to the ACLU decades ago. It was when the Klan was organizing a march through Skokie, Illinois, suburb of Chicago, most noted for its high percentage of population of Holocaust survivors. And the Klan was going to march in Skokie. And the ACLU defended the First Amendment rights of the Klan to do that. I hate those Klansmen. I despise everything they stand for, everything they say. First Amendment applies to them too. So I held my nose, I wrote the check to the ACLU, and I've been doing it every year since then. Always found a time when the ACLU was defending somebody I despised, and that motivates me to write that check, write that donation. By that same principle, we impose upon ourselves the moral imperative of obeying our laws of war, and every veteran has pledged to do just that. Now, most countries don't do this, at least not to the extent that we do, but that moral imperative, that legal obligation to follow the laws of war, includes this. It includes the obligation on all soldiers to disobey an unlawful order. I learned that in basic training as a private, that it's my, of course we're taught to obey orders. Instant unquestioning obedience. That's what we train people in basic training to do. Except when it's an unlawful order. And then we are legally, by the Uniform Code of Military Justice, we are legally obligated to disobey an unlawful order. That obligation includes taking responsibility for rendering judgment about whether or not an order is legal, like torture, and taking responsibility for the consequences if our personal individual judgment that that's an illegal order is wrong. If we get it wrong, we face UCMJ punishment. But if we don't disobey the lawful, that unlawful order, we face UCMJ punishment. It's codified in the laws of war, our laws of war. At My Lai, most of those soldiers refused to obey the direct orders from their commander on the ground to murder innocent civilians. Only a couple did that. But there were a bunch of other soldiers there. They wouldn't do it. They refused to obey the order. Two, helicopter pilots, warrant officers, who are technically lower ranking than the officer in charge on the ground there, flying over, they saw what was happening. They landed their helicopter. They jumped out of the helicopter, and they threatened that officer in charge with force, threatened to kill him if he didn't stop that. And they did it because that was the morally right thing to do, and their actions were in accordance with the law of war. American veterans are called to be different from other countries' veterans of their country's wars. That difference has to do with the difference between our understanding of national interests and the understanding most other countries throughout history have had of their national interests. Our national interests are a function of our national values. We're a country in mission to advocate by our example for our national values of freedom, justice, peace, and opportunity. Other countries, mostly, fight for national interests and national identity as a function of their traditions, their borders, their economic interests beyond their borders, or their heritage of ethnic or religious identity. History is full of examples of wars of conquest, territorial expansion, and colonial exploitation out of greed and racial, religious, and tribal superiority. Other countries chant their war cries of blood and soil, for example. Blood and soil as an excuse for war is fundamentally un-American. Real Americans don't fight for dirt, but we will fight to defend and advocate for our values. That's a developmental process. We are still learning how to do that. It's still a viable, vivid challenge. An example of that development is the difference in concept of why we fight between the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. Revolutionary War, our soldiers, our warriors, advocated for the value of freedom through a war designed to set ourselves free. In the Civil War, a developmental process took place from the beginning of the Civil War through about a halfway point purpose of the war changed. The purpose of the Civil War became a war to set other people free. An insight from World War II. This may have been the first time in history. Historians argue about this, but many will say this is the first time in history when civilians, just run-of-the-mill farmers, for example, caught in the horror of a war they had nothing to do with starting, didn't want to participate in, just want to be left alone, but they're caught up in this horror and the destruction of war. And they see coming over the hill, down toward their farmhouse, a group of warriors, mostly young, but nevertheless, experienced, hardened killers from a foreign land. And those civilians were glad to see them. First time in history, glad to see them, welcomed them, because they were Americans who brought with them not conquest, but hope and freedom. In those very rare times in our national history when we have valid, compelling reasons to wage war, we are called by that fundamental national mission based on our national values to bring not conquest or exploitation, but freedom and hope. If we wage war for reasons of greed and perverse visions of empire, we betray our national values and we subvert our own national interests, regardless of the short-term outcomes of the war. Most likely, when we betray our values and thereby subvert our interests, the outcome of that war will be a long and bloody failure. Summarize it all in a story. This is a personal example from Liberia, the United Nations military mission. There were only 10 of us Americans on that entire UN military force, and there were 10 or 15,000 soldiers from a bunch of different countries there. My job was to get in the helicopter, old Soviet-era helicopter, bucket of bolts, flown by some really competent Ukrainian pilots who were sober most of the time. We'd fly around the country, and I had Muhammad Kamara with me, and Moses Jarbo, who was the director of their National Commission for Disarmament and all of this stuff. And we'd go to these remote villages out in the jungle, and we had to land the helicopter away from the village. We learned the hard way that if you land near the village, you blow the thatched roofs off the huts. And you call the villagers in for a meeting, and that just doesn't brief well. So we find a clear spot out in the jungle, and we had this little parade into the village, to have a meeting with the people. And I was greeted by a village elder, and the village elder brought with him, it's kind of like a Pied Piper, he was the messenger, he was the person who called people from out of the bush into the meeting. And he's this little guy all painted up, feathers, loincloth, barefoot. And he had this flute. And I said, who is this guy? I'm asking the village elder. The elder said, oh, that's not a messenger. It's the messenger who calls the people to me. How does he do that? With the flute. So we're walking along this little parade. The guy out front's got the flute. People are joining. People are coming in. By the time we got to the village, there was a whole bunch of people already there and a bunch of people in our little parade to come to the meeting there. I asked the village elder, I said, how did he do that? With a flute. What did he say with that flute? And the village elder said, peace is here. The UN is here. And one of them is an American. Thank you.
Comments? Discussion?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your service. And two things. You know, last week we sang "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" And you know, you give us hope. And also, our civil Cold War, which we are in right now, there is hope. And thank you for communicating that to me.
Good. Yes.
I wanted to know about Afghanistan, and you said that you agreed with going into Afghanistan, and I have mixed conflicting information about Afghanistan and what is still going on there.
Yeah, big difference between what has been going on since, I don't know, about 2004, 2005, and what we did initially. And the betrayal of the mission originally in Afghanistan came about when we invaded Iraq. That we deserted the mission in Afghanistan in order to provide resources to go to Iraq and steal oil. Our motives had to be honorable in Afghanistan. They don't have any oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about our continuing support of the Saudis in Yemen?
Oh, that's a mistake. For 100 years, we, not just the United States, but the French, the British, mainly, and then, God help us, we took over that mistake, had been pursuing a really immoral strategy with respect to the Middle East, and particularly with respect to the coddling of the Kingdom of Saud. That was a British invention. There's no Kingdom of Saud. But Westerners invented one, imposed it upon the Saudi people in order to control oil. It's all about oil. And it's been about oil for 100 years. And we've been paying that price for 100 years.
I can just say I just hope and pray that there are many more like you serving in the military today.
Oh, there are. There are. I mean, a bunch.
Just kind of to address that, I'm career military as well, 21 years in the Marine Corps. And when you join, every time you're promoted as commanding officer, I've ministered it many times, you take an oath. Your oath is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And as you're in there, you put all that aside. Legal orders is what you are required to follow. And you put aside all of your feelings about whether or not it is the correct thing to do. Now that I'm out, I can express my opinions about Afghanistan. I can express my opinions about going into Iraq. As a voter, I can express my opinions about that. And that is our job. The best thing we can do for our military folks, in my opinion, is to not send them unnecessarily into harm's way. And but once you're there, there's very little discussion, I guess, about the moral implications of what you're doing. I mean, there is, obviously, but your job is not at that point. You have determined that my job is to, you know, I have committed myself to the military mission here, and I hope and pray that the mission that I'm given is a moral mission. And I guess that's all I wanted to say.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Mike.
Before you sit down, Bruce, to bring it to very current times, the proposal to send military down to the border with Mexico, with the refugees who are coming north, they're civilians. So how do you square that with sending military?
I can tell you this. See, the military's been on the border for a long time, many years. Obama sent them there. It was even before that. During the Bush administration, and then the Obama administration continued. There have been National Guard soldiers along that border performing a legally appropriate mission to secure and strengthen that border. They're there to back up civilian law enforcement. And that's the way you can use certainly National Guard and active duty soldiers on American soil. You can't do that. You can't use soldiers for a military mission according to our law. Posse comitatus. Can't
rule
do it.
Law.
Rule of law. Now, I can tell you this, I don't care who orders an American soldier, some guy from the 10th Mountain Division or the 1st Division, to shoot some women and children, not going to happen. They won't do it. Yes.
My understanding from a long time ago, and things have changed over the years, but the National Guard was created to protect our borders.
Well, actually,
and
no.
They didn't shoot anybody.
No.
They are there. I mean, they have a legal right to be on that border to protect us.
No, the National Guard is 300 years old. Predates the U.S. Army.
Their mission has changed. They don't have a mission any longer to protect our borders?
Not borders specifically, no. Now, the National Guard has two missions. The strategic military mission, when called, attacked and duty
right.
by the president to go wherever.
Right.
And do that. The other mission, the active army doesn't have it. And that mission is to provide backup to law enforcement, to provide an army at the order of the governor, not the order of the president, to back up, for local community security and to back up law enforcement by force if necessary. For example, civilian airports. After 9/11, there was no TSA. There were some contractors. I was the commander of the military forces that protected the airports, provided security in the airports, all 9 big civilian airports in the state of Georgia, with National Guard soldiers, armed. And if an FBI agent, federal agent, for example, were present and somebody showed up waving a machine gun or something like that in an airport, the FBI agent is just another guy with a cell phone. That National Guard soldier can kill him.
Well, I just read the mission statement for the National Guard this week again, and I clearly read in there that their one of their missions.
Yeah, one of their missions can
one
be
of their
in order to do so.
Is to protect our borders.
Yeah, and that's why they've been there on that southern border for. Decades. Most people don't realize this, but think globe, Russian bombers, back Cold War, Russian bombers coming to the United States to deliver atomic bombs. They're not coming east to west. They're coming over the North Pole. That's the shortest route. So we had an Air Force mission, mainly Air Force mission, to shoot them down before they got there. They could get here in cooperation with the Canadian Air Force. It wasn't an Air Force mission. It was Air National Guard for decades. So protect borders? Oh, yeah. That's one of the missions.
One more question. Yeah. Look, I'd just like to make a comment about the volunteer army or voluntary military service. I'm absolutely against it. I feel that there should be conscription, and that thereby you have a good cross-section of the population, plus the politicians' children will tend to also be involved, and that will be less opportunity for them to fight these very unnecessary wars. I mean, what is your feeling about the...
I have always agreed with you.
Right, all right.
And I felt that way during Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When I, as a college student, I was given a college deferment. Now, how unfair is that? And when I showed up as a freshman, it was just one of the things you did. You signed this little paper to apply for it. The next semester, when I enrolled, I didn't do it. I didn't apply for that college deferment. It was just unfair. I think we ought to have national service across the board.
Yes.
Men,
yes.
Women, rich, poor, everybody. You do something.
I think that's a good discussion.
Military is one option. Bedpan duty in the local hospital is another.
Is that on the table?
Doesn't Israel have
Israel has duty, yes. Well, maybe we can emulate Israel. That's another time to discuss. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bruce.
Something else to say to you afterwards.
Our closing, I just want to thank Bruce for his wonderful comments and food for thought and his service. We're going to, our closing song, hymn number 149, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Stand if you can.
Stand if you can.